We would like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Preborn. When a mother meets her baby on an ultrasound and hears their heartbeat, it's a divine connection, and the majority of the time, she will choose life. But she can't do it without our help. Preborn needs us, the pro-life community, to come alongside her. One ultrasound is just $28. To donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby, or visit preborn.com.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview. The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning and happy Friday. Today is March 22nd, and earlier this week on Monday, the Supreme Court heard arguments in Murphy versus Missouri, which started out as Missouri versus Biden. This is, of course, the free speech case that questions what the government can do in terms of censorship of individuals who are speaking against what the government prefers, and at what point does pressure and direct requests from the government turn big media platforms like formerly Twitter, now X, Facebook, and some of those into government agents when they are doing the bidding of what the government tells them to. And so we broke this down earlier this week, but I want to revive this topic for the Friday because we have with us today Dr. Jay Bhattacharya, who is actually one of the plaintiffs in that case. And he, of course, was one that was censored broadly on social media during the COVID pandemic, talking about a different narrative completely than what Dr. Fauci and some of these other people were suggesting at the time. And so, Jay, thank you so much for joining. And you told me right before the program started that you actually were at the Supreme Court for oral arguments. So let's go to that. But first, tell me the background of the case in terms of your involvement before we got to the Supreme Court.
Sure. So the case was brought by the Missouri and Louisiana Attorney General's offices in August of 2022, almost like 2 years ago. And I had been working with the Missouri Attorney General's office on a very variety of like anti-lockdown, anti-mask mandate, anti-vax mandate cases. And so they knew about me, and they asked if, when they brought the case, they asked if I would be interested in participating as a plaintiff, because they also knew that I had been an advocate against all those things, and that for that, that the social media companies had suppressed a lot of my messages advocating against those lockdowns, against mask mandates, vax mandates, and so on. The discovery in the case was amazing, Jenna, absolutely amazing. We got to depose Tony Fauci. We got to depose this man named Elvis Chan from the FBI. We got to depose people from the Attorney General's office, from the CDC, and so on. And it was striking because, and when we could read the emails, we found basically a pattern of every single government agency we saw leaning on social media companies, basically threatening them to pull down posts, to censor people at scale. Even true things, like if you formed a vax injury group with like true vax injuries that happened, they pushed Facebook to take those groups down so the patients couldn't have support from each other. They systematically, and the thing is that they pull down things that were true over and over and over. If you were against mask mandates, or if you were against vaccines as a way to stop, to prevent people from getting COVID when the data said it couldn't, didn't matter. They got pulled down, and they threatened social media companies that if they didn't listen, implicitly anyways, they threatened them that if they didn't obey, they would go after them, on a regulatory basis, go after their business. The lower court found they call it an Orwellian censorship, Orwellian Ministry of Truth, the censorship industrial complex. The appeals court, the Fifth Circuit appeals court, called it akin to what Al Capone would do in Chicago, you know, the gangster. The government would go to businesses and in effect say, that's a nice business you got there, to be shame if something were to happen to it, to force their censorship. And so that's the background of the oral argument. The lower court said, ordered the Biden administration to stop doing it, and the Supreme Court was hearing the preliminary injunction whether or not they should stop doing it.
Yeah, and obviously, I think in any rational person's view, and especially contemplating the constitutional protections that the First Amendment provides against the government being hamstrung, to use the words of Justice Jackson, that's a good thing, to say that the government should be limited in how they're able to censor and infringe upon Americans' right to freedom of speech, even through these platforms. And so fast forward to the Supreme Court oral argument that that you observed in person, I listened online, and it seems to be that there was a controversy over what the Solicitor General on behalf of the Biden administration was suggesting, that, oh, we as the government were just encouraging, we were just informing and suggesting to these social media, like, no pressure at all. Like, they didn't have to take our advice or anything. I mean, that to me was just so patently ridiculous.
I mean, it was ridiculous, Jenna. If you read the emails, they were threatening them. I mean, they were like, there was vile language. There was like insistent pressure over and over and over again. And always with the backdrop of, you know, if we come knocking, we have regulatory powers over you. The FBI was involved in the censorship effort. I mean, if you get the FBI at your door, you're going to be worried. You're going to try to comply with what they're telling you. And so that was absolutely ridiculous. The other thing the government said, which absolutely floored me, they kept saying over and over again that this is an emergency. It was a really difficult, different time. And they explicitly said, well, although we shouldn't get as a precedent, maybe there's a vaccine exemption to the First Amendment, that the government ought to be able to suppress free speech. It doesn't like your criticisms of the vaccines, even if the criticisms of the vaccines are true. It didn't matter. As long as it contradicts government policy, then the government ought to be able to suppress your free speech around it. That absolutely floored me. The premise seemed to be that the government got all these things right, and they were just trying to, in a benign way, instruct the American public by suppressing free speech, and they were suppressing misinformers. But Jenna, they got everything wrong. Everything wrong. From the very beginning of the pandemic, what was the infection fatality rate? They got that wrong. What was the risk stratification? Was it really the case that everyone was equally at risk of dying if they got the COVID? They got that wrong. Was school closures a good idea? They got that wrong. Were lockdowns necessary? Good idea. Were religious restrictions a good idea? They got those things wrong. Does the mask work to stop the disease? They got that wrong. Did the vaccine stop you from getting and spreading COVID? They got that wrong. Are there side effects from vaccines? They got that wrong. The vaccine mandates further the cause of public health. They got that wrong. And people who got it right, the government was suppressing those people. It was absolutely shocking. The justices seemed not to understand that the government wasn't a benign actor here. Even from a public health perspective, the government got the science wrong, got the public health wrong, and it censored the critics who got it right.
And I was very, likewise, disappointed in the attorney and the advocate that was arguing on behalf of Missouri and Louisiana, the two then attorneys general who now, you know, Eric Schmidt is a senator, and of course Jeff Landry is the governor of Louisiana, but arguing on behalf of the plaintiffs in this case, that he didn't make that same distinction and say, you know, listen, we're all presuming here that there was a direct harm to the overall awareness of the American people about the COVID pandemic. They got it wrong. But even if they got it right, that still doesn't mean that you should be able to censor Americans' opinions who want to express something different than the government's view on a pandemic. Or if they say, you know, if the government is saying the only way that we can combat this is by everybody getting the vaccine. If somebody else, if other doctors want to weigh in and say, well, we have these other therapeutics that we think are just as successful, or here's our opinion. I mean, reasonable people can disagree. I mean, I don't think there's ever been a consensus in the medical community, the legal community on anything. I mean, this is why you go and get a second opinion, for example. And that's been something that everybody is so familiar with. But to not point that out in oral argument about how drastically wrong the government was, there was this presumption in the oral argument that the government was acting in the best interests of society. And Ketanji Brown Jackson, Justice Jackson, even highlighted that by saying, you know, well, the government should be able to speak, and it almost has a duty to inform the public. And it sounded like this was such a noble lie.
I mean, she had a really funny hypothetical that she raised of, well, what if there's a social media fad of kids jumping out of windows, of increasingly higher and higher windows from, you know, taller and taller buildings, kids die as a result of the social media fad. Doesn't the government have an obligation to censor that kind of speech by social media companies? But, you know, there's an irony there. It was the government that told the schools to close. In effect, metaphorically, they told kids to jump out of windows, and then censored critics who said, don't jump out of windows. I mean, it was absolutely just mind-blowing to hear the premise that somehow the government was a benign actor here. I wanted to return to your point that you made, which I completely agree with. It didn't, in a sense, it doesn't matter that we got it right. They got it wrong. The First Amendment doesn't. It applies even to incorrect speech. But but on science, as you said, Jenna, which I agree with entirely, it's very difficult to know what's right and wrong up front when you have a novel situation. There's lots of science coming out. You have to have free speech. It's the only way that science goes forward. If you don't have free speech, you don't have science. And the government presuming that it knew the truth up in advance, well, how could it know that with such certainty, such that it wanted to suppress its critics? It's the kind of hubris that leads to tremendous damage, which is exactly what happened. So many lives lost, so many businesses closed, so many people's lives disrupted, kids depressed and with lack of schooling. I mean, you have huge learning loss, the economic damage, all of that, much of that might have been averted had we been allowed to speak to each other. The free speech rights apply to people who are both right and wrong, but especially in cases where there's a lot of like controversy and developing science, you definitely need free speech. You can't have the government presume to take a position that as if it knows best. It's not an omniscient entity.
Yes, and that is such an important distinction and point. Dr. Jay Bhattacharya, my special guest this morning, talking about the Murthy versus Missouri case and the oral argument at the Supreme Court, because the American premise and the principle that our country was founded on is that the way to combat other people's opinions or things that you believe are false or things that are in fact false is with more speech and more truth and more ideas, and this idea that in the public forum, reasonable people can make up their own minds and we have a right to disagree, and there is no one person that or entity like the government especially that is this ministry of truth or the arbiter of truth. And of course, you know, we do have defamation law and some of those things that if you are lying about an individual and a false fact, but that is very narrow. We're not talking about a general topic of public concern or even just of personal interest. I mean, those things, you know, defamation is a very, very narrow subset of the overall ability to speak freely, and especially when it relates to public figures. I mean, the standard is so high, and we've talked about it on this show a lot, you know, the New York Times versus Sullivan standard, all of those things. But nobody is suggesting that this type of, you know, novel situation or a view of what the pandemic was and, you know, according to some people, still is, you know, in terms of the science, that there was one definitive viewpoint that was provably true or false, especially at the time that the censorship was going on. And so how does this, in your view, Jay, How important is this case ultimately, not just to free speech and political opinion overall, but to science and the medical profession and the ability of people to truly engage with trying to understand what's going on to make their own decisions in their own best interests of their personal health?
I think this is the most important First Amendment case, certainly of the 21st century. I mean, probably the last 50 years. It's the first real case that the Supreme Court is going to get to weigh in on what are the contours of free speech in the internet age, in the social media age. They haven't really weighed in on that, and so I think whichever way this case goes will determine whether our country still really has a First Amendment in the 21st century, at least as far as free speech is concerned. You mentioned actually, Jenna, about defamation. One of the things that the government continued to try to do, and I think it seems like a lot of the justices seem confused about, is that they conflated the restriction on the government being able to go and tell social media companies who and what to censor, what ideas to censor, for legal speech. There's nothing in the preliminary injunction that prevents the government from going and saying, look, this person is a terrorist. You should not allow him to share his ideas. I mean, you know, so this is a foreign terrorist. You shouldn't allow him to share his ideas or foment insurrection or something, right? This person there are still defamation laws. There are still laws against, laws against child porn. None of that is touched by this ruling. The key thing here is that it says the government shouldn't be allowed to go and tell social media companies to take down legal speech, especially speech on the most important public policy topics of the day. If the government is allowed to do that, then there really is no limit. We have an authoritarian government. We don't have a government by and for the people anymore.
Yeah, and that is such an important point in this overall conversation, is that it's almost like the government was suggesting to the justices on the Supreme Court that there are no restraints at all on speech, and you know, everybody can just do whatever they want, and this is wild, and you got to restrain this in this context, and yet not appreciating that we already do have an entire body of case law. And we're coming up on a break here in just about a minute and a half, but I also want to get into your thoughts on, you know, the other topic that I didn't think was touched on at all, interestingly, and I've mentioned this on this show this week several times, which is, the idea of prior restraint. Because what I saw happening to people like you, for example, is that if you made, you know, one or a couple of statements that in the government's view deserved to be censored, and then your account through the social media tech giants ended up being suspended based on that, it wasn't so much that you were suspended based on your prior statements, but the fact that you might put out more misinformation in the future. And that, to me, is an issue of prior restraint, that we have an entire body of case law that is dedicated to saying the government can't do that. I mean, publishers cannot do that. So I want to get your response to that. On the flip side of the break, we'll be right back with more with Dr. Jay Bhattacharya here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning. Last year, because of you, Preborn's network of clinics saw over 58,000 babies saved. Thank you to all who made this possible. Let's celebrate these precious babies. Daisy and her husband decided they never wanted kids. When she found out she was pregnant, she immediately thought abortion. But after she and her husband met her baby on an ultrasound and heard the heartbeat, their hearts melted and they chose life. Her baby, Jeffrey, is healthy and beautiful. Daisy and her husband can't even imagine life without him. Each of these babies are truly miraculous, and every day, Preborn celebrates 200 miracles. $28 a month can be the difference between the life and the death of a child. When a mother meets her baby on ultrasound and hears their heartbeat, it's a divine connection that doubles the baby's chance at life. Let's join together and help mothers choose life. Just dial #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby, or visit preborn.com. That's preborn.com.
Speaking truth with love. This is Jenna Ellis in the morning.
Welcome back, and I'm talking with Dr. Jay Bhattacharya, who is my special guest this morning, about the Murthy versus Missouri case that was argued Monday at the U.S. Supreme Court. This, of course, being the most important free speech case, I think he and I both agree, in the 21st century, and certainly in, you know, in the last several decades, because of this idea that private companies like social media can become agents of the government and censor speech in a public forum like social media. And yet the argument from the government is that, you know, no, we're just asking, we're trying to persuade, and this is so benign. They don't actually be they're not actually transformed into agents of the state when we are basically compelling them to do our bidding. And so before the break, Dr. Jay, I was asking you this question about prior restraint, because to me, there is a big difference between, okay, this particular tweet that is already out there, or this post violates the terms and conditions, you know, the TOS and all of that. And of course, we can debate whether the terms of service are actually fair and all of those things. But if it's a tweet in the past, that's very different than, I think, what has occurred here, because a lot of these social media companies were censoring accounts that they were concerned, and I think a lot of the Twitter files show, they were concerned about future posting. I mean, doesn't that get into the whole idea of prior restraint?
It absolutely does. A few notes on that. So one, the government, via both directly and via intermediaries, often pressured the companies to change their terms of service. I mean, that I don't see how that doesn't involve, entail this prior restraint problem. Because if you have the government saying you have to change your terms of service so that broad categories of speeches are not even allowed before this even said, that's, I mean, that's certainly prior restraint. The other thing about my particular situation, so I was never directly suspended from Twitter. Instead, what happened to me was I was put on a blacklist. There were scientists like Martin Kulldorff who were suspended off of Twitter, not allowed to talk, and LinkedIn, basically, you know, almost every social media platform saw this. And that is certainly prior restraint, exactly the way you say. I mean, it's that the idea is that this person's so dangerous that the government is telling the social media company, don't let this person speak. Robert F. Kennedy faced that, as did journalist Alex Berenson. So you had, you know, prior restraint happening basically all over the place at the behest of the government. Let me tell you the flip side of that, which is that I was looking at what's happening to my friends who were posting things that they basic scientific truths that they would see on the vaccines or on masks or so on, and I censored myself, Jenna. I saw where the line was up to the point where you would get knocked off, and I didn't cross that line because I wanted to make sure that I didn't. You know, when you're knocked off of a platform, essentially it's a kind of defamation by the platform. The platform is essentially saying, "Oh, this person is so wrong that no one should hear him." And for scientists, that's really a bad black mark on you. And so I didn't want that, and so I censored myself. So it's not just that it caused prior restraint formally by knocking people off. More broadly, it caused people to not say what they believed, which is, or not fully state their beliefs, because, and that I think is, again, really quite dangerous. It's the kind of line that, you know, totalitarian powers impose on people. Like, it takes moral courage in a totalitarian state to speak. Why should it take moral courage to speak in the United States, which is devoted to the idea of free speech? It's part of our civic religion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so well said. I mean, what you're describing was basically, because they were exercising this kind of prior restraint against other accounts, it was having a chilling effect on your speech because you could not have the freedom to post all the things that you wanted to for fear that the government, through these agents and through these big tech companies, would then come and censor you similarly. And that also would have an effect, of course, on, you know, reputational harm. I mean, all of these other things. And so there are a lot of collateral consequences here. And this is why this is such an important case, I think, not just because of the pandemic and public health concerns. But I think if you extrapolate the effect that this would have more broadly, if the White House, whoever is in it, was telling these big tech platforms, we don't like what this particular group or these a couple of individuals or whoever it is, we don't like what they have to say because that's harming our narrative, and the government is the Ministry of Truth, and they can determine what is true and false, then that will necessarily have a chilling effect on everybody if the Supreme Court ultimately decides, yeah, it's okay for big tech to silence people in this fashion based on the strong persuasion or the compelling nature of this government push. And so overall, I mean, I think that Dr. J, people really need to be aware of how the social media platforms have influenced a lot of public perception. I mean, this has become really the public forum like it used to be in the theaters of around, you know, in ancient Greece and all of this. This has become the public forum. And if we aren't allowed as individuals, regardless of our profession or politics or anything else, if we're not able to speak freely in these forums without fear of censorship, then we are no better than some of these propagandist communist countries. I mean, where does this ultimately lead?
I mean, I think it's the end of the republic. I mean, at least as we know it. If you don't have free speech, if you don't have the kind of free speech that allows people to not worry that the government is looking over your shoulder to make sure that you can't say what you want to say, that is suppressing the reach of the natural reach of your speech, that you're gonna get effectively defamed. You know, non-transparently, right? It's one thing for the government to get up and say, well, Jay's saying X, we disagree with X. I mean, they're completely free to say that. I mean, but President Biden can get up and say he disagrees with me, whatever he wants, he can get up and say. No one's stopping him from doing that. He also has free speech. But what happened in this case, what happened during the pandemic is not that. What happened during the pandemic is that the government went behind the scenes quietly so that no one even could see and told social media companies to suppress these people. Often the people that were being suppressed didn't even know they were being suppressed. So although I'm a plaintiff in the case, there's like five named plaintiffs, really the real plaintiffs in this case are basically the entire American population. The American population was subject to a regime that could quietly go back behind their back and say, look, this person shouldn't be allowed to say what he wants to say. He shouldn't be heard. And they wouldn't even know. That's the nature of the way social media companies work. I was put on a blacklist by Twitter. The day I joined Twitter in August of 2021, I was put on a blacklist. I found this out during the Twitter files. I actually got to go visit Twitter headquarters, talk with Elon Musk, and see the Twitter database. And I didn't know that I was on this blacklist, but the blacklist basically said that I could do a post, but only my followers would see it. No one else would have any chance of seeing it. The way that Twitter works, it's not just your followers should see it. Everyone, you have a chance that if it's really a popular post, many people can see it. Maybe millions of people can see it. But I had no chance of that because they put a thumb on the scale because the government asked Twitter, in effect, I mean, I believe, to put me on the blacklist.
And that's such a great point as well, is all of these visibility reduction tools and the shadow banning and all of this, that until we had the Twitter files, people knew that just intuitively and also seeing their engagement, seeing the post reach, all of that, but didn't have, you know, concrete evidence until that and proof that this was actually happening. And that's such a great point as well, is that what types of manipulation on the reach of speech can be done that is that is still allowed under the First Amendment for these types of algorithms. And I think all of those questions really need to be contemplated by the Supreme Court. And also to underscore one other thing that you said as well, Dr. J, is that, you know, the government has the ability to speak. I mean, they have a huge megaphone. I mean, you know, President Biden can call, you know, for all of the networks to, you know, have an address from the Oval Office. I mean, none of us have those kinds of, you know, privileges. And yet it's like they're suggesting that, oh, the poor little government victim that, you know, is being bullied by all of these people who are suggesting different opinions. And what is the little government to do but to, you know, try in their little best efforts to, you know, go and combat all of this nonsense. And it's like this again, it's so ridiculous. But, you know, as you're sitting there listening to these arguments, do you think that at least the conservative justices understand some of these finer points as it relates to social media? Because, you know, as far as I'm aware, I mean, you know, Justice Roberts isn't sitting there in chambers on his Twitter account. So, you know, I mean, maybe some of his clerks are, but do our justices have an awareness of how big of an issue this is?
I don't know, Jenna. I went into the case incredibly optimistic. I mean, I've never been to a Supreme Court oral arguments before. I had tingles in on my spine as I walked in. You know, I never thought I'd be sort of involved in a case that I think is going to go down in American history. But as I walked out, I was repressed. I couldn't tell where several of the conservative justices were, and certainly the liberal justices. I really thought, and this is how naive I was, I thought it would be a slam dunk 9-0 case that everyone agreed that free speech rights belong in are central to the American Republic. I don't think that the liberal justices have any notion of that, and at least three of the I don't know where they are, Jenna. I don't know what they're going to decide on this case. I left depressed. I mean, I brought up something earlier. I want to just emphasize it again. This case is not just about me. It's about the millions and millions of Americans who were silenced without their knowing it by the government. About basically every American that was deprived of the full conversation that they deserved during the pandemic regarding the science of the pandemic. The government kept saying things like, we need to be able to trace directly how, Jay's speech or whatever was suppressed by a government demand, as if there needs to be an email trail saying, okay, suppress Jay's speech. And that's the only time you can say that they suppressed. But they suppressed ideas, whole classes of ideas that you weren't allowed to speak about. You weren't allowed to think it. If the standard is you have to be able to like show an email chain. Well, by the way, we have email chains for some of the folks that were plaintiffs. But why do you have to show that? The government should not be allowed to suppress a whole class of ideas, and then the only way we get redress is by some email chain. We need to allow everyone to be protected, whether you can directly show the email chain or not. The government shouldn't be allowed to go tell social media companies, don't allow anyone to talk about these things. That itself should be illegal, even if you can't name the person that was directly affected by it.
Right. I mean, in a criminal or even civil law context, I mean, we use circumstantial evidence all the time to prove a direct premise. And so this idea that you have to have this direct email chain saying, you know, here is government telling social media ban X person explicitly. I mean, we've never used that as a standard of proof in almost any other legal context. And so it is a ridiculous standard that they're approaching. But to your other point as well about how the liberal justices are interpreting this, I mean, it is a very scary idea when you look at some of the questions that were posed by Justice Sotomayor and Justice Jackson in particular, that they clearly had a worldview fundamentally different of the legitimacy of government and how it operates in society. And its duties, and one of those being the duty to be limited in American in our American constitutional republic, and the idea that they had no real fidelity to that very important premise, in my view, just underscores why we need to ensure that judicial appointments are fully vetted, and that people like Justice Jackson don't attain a seat on the highest court in the land, because, and this is why the judicial philosophy of of prospective justices or federal judges or even on the state level are so important. And, you know, we had this whole conversation nationally in 2016 when Justice Scalia's seat was open. But I think that we've almost, in a way, strayed a little bit from that. I mean, the left, of course, is talking about it because they're very mad that, you know, we have a conservative majority now, which I would differ with that a little bit. I don't think we have a reliable conservative majority, but, you know, they're talking about packing the court. And now that, you know, the institution is just terrible because of the Trump ballot case, which is completely ridiculous. But how important to our constitutional republic, and I think you said it well, that this would be the end of it if this case turns out differently. But how important is it that we revive that emphasis on judicial nominees, especially heading into the next presidential election? And I know that you're not as political, but just from a good citizen and, you know, lover of American and our constitutional republic perspective.
I mean, I don't watch the court obsessively like some of my lawyer friends do, but so I shouldn't talk
like
too
me.
Much about
okay.
generally. But let me just say, one thing that Justice Jackson said absolutely floored me. She seemed to, maybe this was just a hypothetical and I misread her, but I don't think so. She expressed shock that. People in the case were trying to use the First Amendment as a way to hinder the government from acting. But I'm just a fringe epidemiologist, Jenna. But when I read the First Amendment, it says Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech. You know, and there are other, you know, freedom of religion, other rights there too. So the key word there is abridge. Congress shall make no law abridging. If Congress makes no law abridging the freedom of speech, then the president and the government and the administrative state also certainly should not have no right to abridge the freedom of speech, because the laws are made by Congress. The only thing you have to do is enforce them.
Right.
So you have it doesn't make sense to me. How could a sitting justice of the Supreme Court express shock that the First Amendment hinders government action, when in fact the whole purpose of it is to prohibit the government from violating a basic right, which is free speech.
Yes. I mean, we want to hamstring the government. That's literally the point of our Constitution, is to put government in its limited power place. And the First Amendment is just a redundancy clause to say, you know, Congress, just in case you weren't clear, and Congress is the only branch of government that can legislate. And if they can't legislate abridging the freedom of speech, then the executive branch has no enforcement power on legislation that Congress can't create anyway. So, I mean, and this is just, you know, basic civics, American civics 101. And yet we have, you know, the diversity hire Karen on the Supreme Court that doesn't get that. But Dr. J, thank you so much. And I hope and pray this case turns out well. We'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Speaking truth with love. This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Welcome back. And for the last segment on a Friday, this headline from our friends over at Not the Bee, the actual news, as opposed to the Babylon Bee, which is satire. Not the Bee. This man's meme about the ideal man started a firestorm in the comment section. And this this post was by an individual who goes by Cool Christian Engineer on X, formerly known as Twitter. And he posted, "Can we all agree, please?" And then there is a graphic of the ideal man. And it's this kind of Chad who's sort of swaggering. And these characteristics: has no female friends, averts his eyes from other women, dresses formally, dates for marriage, loves his mother, intellectually stimulating, romantically old-fashioned, can handle heavy labor, exercises, respects women, elder, and children, can support a whole family, will lead his family to God, wants kids, cares for animals, only has friends of similar characteristics. So the Not the Bee author, who's also anonymous, which is kind of funny, says, "In my humble opinion, the whole meme is a little bit cheesy, and the can we all agree is some obvious rage bait," but then goes on to post some of the responses from, I think, a lot of leftists. One in particular saying, "A man having no female friends is an enormous red flag." And a lot of the responses on social media, in my view, just scanning some of these, seemed to be really focused on this whole idea of having no female friends and only having friends of similar characteristics. So we invited the cool Christian engineer to come on and talk about this, because I actually agree that this is not just an ideal man, but this is a biblical view of what a Christian in a biblical marriage should look like. And it doesn't just go for men. This goes for women as well, because this isn't just about not having friends of the opposite sex. And yes, there are only two genders, but about not having relationships that get into your feelings, and especially complaining about your spouse or giving, you know, your big, deep, dark secrets to someone else that should be confined to the institution of marriage. So the cool Christian engineer joins me now. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you doing?
Good. Thanks so much for coming on. So so what was your, I guess, rationale for posting this? Is this your original meme, or is this something that you just kind of wanted to provoke all of the people on the internet?
Well, I actually did not have any bad intentions with this tweet. I just saw somebody reply with this meme to my account, and I was like, oh, that's an interesting meme. I'm going to post it and see if people agree. But I didn't think at all that this was going to generate such controversy as it did.
Yeah, and you know, and I think, though, that a lot of the even Christians who have kind of grown up in this cultural generation of viewing marriage and family as just lifestyle choices, rather than going back to the biblical worldview and what the Bible actually commands for marriage and family, that's the underlying worldview premise of the pushback. Because people are saying, well, why can't I have female friends as a man? Or women saying, why can't I have male friends? Why can't I? Rather than focusing on the biblical worldview. So what is, and I've kind of reviewed some of your other posts as well, and it seems that your account is trying to focus on the biblical worldview rather than just this cultural lifestyle narrative.
Yes, my account is mostly on how to be a Christian. It's about prayer. It's about exalting God and all of those things. Sometimes I do dive a little bit into the cultural side and what a man is supposed to be, what a woman is supposed to do, things like that. And this was one of those instances, but with the amount of pushback that it got, it made me think that maybe I should focus more on this side, because there's a bigger need in the cultural side. Most people are nominal Christians, and they just think that their Christianity can be something that they can keep in the privacy of the room. But Jesus didn't die for them privately. They died for them publicly. And they should also profess their faith publicly. And it's not a bad list. Honestly, the list that I posted is, but it got a lot of controversy. As I said, like, some people were telling me that this is a red flag for abuse, not having female friends, and nonsense like that. Like, for example, another person, like the racist left that can only see through the eyes of racism, they said, oh, only having friends of similar characteristics, and this means that you only want to have white friends.
Wow. Well, I mean, and the meme also has a cartoon of, you know, the swaggering Chad who is white. So I can totally see why, you know, they would, of course, seize on that, which is totally ridiculous. But only having friends of similar characteristics, I took that in context to mean that your friends, the people that you rely on for advice, that you go to for counsel, that you know, share and do life with, should be other Christians or people of similar moral values and virtue, not, you know, anything about skin color.
Yeah, absolutely. That's what I mean. For example, I love my dad a lot, but he is of the world. And when I have advice, or when I want to ask for somebody's advice on my relationship, my marriage, I go to the elders of my church, and I don't go to my father, because my father doesn't share the same worldview that I share. And even though I love him a lot, a lot of the advice that he gives me is worldly advice.
Yeah, and that is such a critical point. I'm talking with Cool Christian Engineer and Anon on X, but, you know, this great account about this, this meme of the ideal man that he posted that, of course, went viral and got all of this pushback. But this does evidence another really important point, that we are required and commanded in Scripture to to live life and to be accountable to other Christians and in the church. And even if our parents or our siblings, do not share our Christian worldview, why would you go to someone who is outside of the Christian faith for advice on your marriage? Because even though, they may be very well-meaning, I mean, I'm sure your father loves you very much, but their advice is going to be predicated on a very different philosophy and take other things into account. And so we as Christians do need to be very careful. I mean, this is why even, all of the hate and other things that I get on social media, I think, your opinion doesn't matter to me at all, because I am only going to listen to critics who are people I would actually go to for advice. And those are people who know my whole life, who know me more as just, the season 4 to 6, Trump World Reality TV show cast member, basically, is what it boiled down to in my life, which is utterly ridiculous. So people who only want to see through one lens or a political lens or, things that are totally irrelevant to the biblical worldview, that's not who I should be taking advice or criticism from. And so, cool, Christian, when you look at, some of these responses and how the culture is viewing relationships in general, and this pushback of saying, only has friends of similar characteristics, has no female friends, what does this tell you about the worldview of the culture that is contrasted from the biblical worldview?
So something that it tells me right away is that people have no idea what proper boundaries are for relationships, and this is why we have such a massive problem of infidelity in the West, and why people can't commit to each other for forever, which is a big problem in my opinion. And so I would say that, for example, not having female friends, I guess it depends how you define female, because I agree with your quote retweet that you said that you shouldn't go out with somebody and confide in them, especially like if I have a problem with my wife and then I go to another woman to tell her about the problems with my wife. That's sort of the thing that I was referring to. And this is, it also tells me that if I didn't have Christ, then I would be just as bad as them. And so this also is supposed to fill us Christians with compassion so that we can preach the gospel to them. It didn't work perfectly in my case, because sometimes they get mad and I have to confess my own sins, getting mad for people insulting me, basically. But I am certainly I'm not going to be treated better than my master, and so I am okay with that. But yes, this basically tells me that people have no idea how relationships between males and females have to be.
That's such a good point. And, and I'm right there with you that I get mad a lot at some of the people that post, and I have to, kind of go back and recenter myself and focus on, the only audience that matters, which is, of course, our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. But this does also evidence as well why, the world is just so hopeless in their relationships. And, we see this, all of the brokenness, all of the loneliness. I think there's an epidemic of loneliness, especially among millennials and Gen Zers, because our culture has created this environment where we're told that relationships and family are just lifestyle preferences and choices rather than the institution of the family and marriage that God has ordained. And and it is very sad to see, how a lot of these people are responding, and yet they are probably not happy themselves ultimately. And so for we as Christians, social media and this whole forum is a very interesting place to try to promote the truth of the gospel of Christ, because we don't have long conversations like this one on social media. It's more just posting a couple of these things. But I think it's done well in the format of your meme, because this is provoking people to think and to really consider what is the ideal or the biblical man, and what are these characteristics, and how should you live your life according to the biblical worldview. So have you gotten any positive feedback from other Christians that are encouraging you to continue to post things that align with Scripture?
Well, yes, I would say that I got a bit of that. It's mostly negative, but the negative aspect comes from non-Christians, so it doesn't affect me as much. But yeah, Christians agreed with me. Some of them had questions of what do you mean by friend? What do you mean by similar characteristics and stuff like that? Like normal questions, and then they see where it was coming from, and they were like, okay, yeah, that makes sense. Even if some of them didn't agree, for example, some friends on Twitter, they say things that, oh, we should absolutely have female friends, which is something that I disagree with. Again, depends how you define friends. Again, I don't want to go outside of my house, basically on a date with another woman,
right,
and talk to her about my wife. So that's what I mean when I say friend. Of course, we all have friends of the opposite sex from church, and when we're with our spouse, we interact with them, we talk to them, we have double dates, but we don't go on a one-on-one, basically outing with them to eat something. That's basically what I was referring to, but the comments were overall positive from Christians. Not all Christians agreed, but yes, mostly positive and very, very negative from the world, which is what I expected.
Yeah, and unfortunately, that is what we expect from the world. But I think you're absolutely right that, you know, obviously we interact with members of the opposite sex daily, but it's a matter of not investing in a friendship outside of the context of marriage that should be sacrosanct. Even me as a single person right now, I don't go out with just, you know, one-on-one with men when it's not a date for that exact reason, because I don't want them to think that, you know. So we need to be more circumspect, but keep doing such great work, cool engineer. Really appreciate you. That's all the time we have for Jenna Ellis in the Morning. Can reach me and my team, Jenna, at AFR.net.
We'd like to thank our sponsors, including Preborn. Preborn has rescued over 200,000 babies from abortion, and every day their network clinics rescue 200 babies' lives. Will you join Preborn in loving and supporting young moms in crisis? Save a life today. Go to preborn.com.